From UFOs to psychic powers and government conspiracies, history is riddled with unexplained events. You can turn back now or learn the stuff they don't want you to know. A production of iHeartRadio.
Welcome back to the show. My name is Matt.
My name is Noel.
They call me Ben. We are joined, as always, with our super producer, Alexis, codename Doc Holliday Jackson. Most importantly, you are you. You are here. And that makes this Stuff They Don't Want You to Know. It's top of the week, so it's time for our strange news segment. I've got to be honest with you, gentlemen. It is getting increasingly difficult to choose a single piece of news per week. Because so many terrible things happen. Now, I didn't think it would be fair to you guys for me to also just like throw headlines at you without telling you in advance. So I'm going to stick with the one I isolated for today. But in the future, I do want to create a laundry list headline segment where we just toss headlines at each other, maybe toward the end. But in the interest of fairness and transparency, I'm just doing the one today. And it's a doozy. All right. So have you ever heard of a guy named Garrison Courtney?
Never.
No, not Garrison Keillor, I assume. No,
Garrison Keillor, who has also been in hot water recently for various things. Garrison Keillor actually said that it was time to give up the fight to preserve Roe versus Wade on a Facebook post, and then he went back and said that his Facebook had been hacked, which is a classic chef's kiss, early 2000s, terrible excuse for posting something regrettable on the internet.
Okay, boomer. Yeah, like people are wise to that one. Yeah.
Yep. So Garrison Keillor and Prairie Home Companion aside, Garrison Courtney is a different person. Garrison Keillor has absolutely nothing to do with today's story. Here's the thing. So Garrison Courtney was once upon a time a high-level spokesperson for the DEA, the Drug Enforcement Administration, and he pleaded guilty this summer to one count of wire fraud in a con that was incredibly audacious, super complicated, and took in a lot of current and former government officials, so much so that when he was caught, people were baffled. He had personally extracted around $4.4 million that we know of from his victims over the course of 4 years. And by the time the FBI was catching up to him, Courtney was in line for something around $4 billion worth of Army, Navy, and Air Force contracts because, you see, he had convinced people that he was a spy for the CIA. That's a hard thing to do. He turned to this because he was his middle-aged former government official. He had a lot of bills that he hadn't paid. He was attempting to get back from his broken marriage, you know, get that third act people talk about in inspirational podcasts and Tony Robbins speeches. He also said he was a CIA operative who might just tell you some war stories and give you a little bit of insider info if you, as a company, would put him on your payroll and give him cover so that he would look like an ordinary citizen and not a deep, like a deep cover spy, essentially. And if they would give him this cover in service to the U.S. government, then Courtney would help them get those very lucrative government contracts.
So these are companies that are already vying for government contracts, or that's like part of their business plan, I guess. Mm-hmm. So he's coming along as like a person saying, I will aid you in your pursuits. Just do this one little thing. Mm-hmm. Change your books around a little bit with my name in there.
Right, right. Just add me as a consultant. You know what I mean? Wow. Another umbrella phrase that's so very useful. And we know that there are CIA operatives working with cover from various companies or from the State Department. That's just part of how the game is played. But what's beautiful to me about this, just objectively from the art of the con here, is that the CIA in real life has so many cagey operations that it lends itself perfectly to the secrecy you would want for a con. Because he would say, you know, I can't tell you everything, okay, buddy, because this is highly classified. I can tell you it might have something to do with some sort of operation somewhere in Africa. But look, if someone tells you the phrase Alpha 214 or First Net, just play it cool. Play it cool. We'll get you that government cheese. Just play ball and nod along. Wow. And the con works because he had so much experience. He was also, you know, he told people he was a Gulf War veteran and so on. He came armed with genuine looking CIA Pentagon documents. He had actual government agents briefing people. He would hold meetings in a type of secure room that'll be familiar to people in the military, but maybe not as familiar to civilians. They're called SCIFs. That's an acronym for Sensitive Compartmented Information Facility. Kind of like, in terms of secrecy, it's almost like a Faraday cage, right? You're yeah. padded down. You can't have your phone.
And aren't they like almost like clean rooms in some ways, where like there's even really intense atmospheric controls? And like, I don't know, for some reason I remember reading something about that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's where you keep the important stuff, and it's where a lot of the important conversations happen. Because again, if someone like the means of infiltrating any government operation are increasingly sophisticated, and so it pays to be paranoid. Here's the thing. At least a dozen of these firms, and to your point, Matt, several of them were already successful defense contractors. At least a dozen of these firms bought into his stories, so they paid him personally more than $4 million. But they didn't know that he never saw any military action. There was no Alpha 214 or First Net or any of those other things. The documents they saw were forged. This guy just had the chutzpah to go in and through like the Jedi application of balls and a lack of consideration of consequences, he was able to pull off a swindle that really should be a film. It sounds like the plot of a spy movie or something, at least his cover story. So you can see this reported in a couple of places. I like what the Daily Beast is writing about it. This has been going on since summer and before then, and I totally missed it. I think a lot of us did because, you know, a lot of other stuff happened this summer. And Courtney was able to keep this going for a while because, like, primarily because he already knew a lot of the players who would be involved. Like, he was convincing generals to sign their companies onto these programs. And it's kind of a Ponzi scheme, right? Because you have to wonder, when does the rubber hit the road, right? When do the MRAPs hit the sand? How are they going to, how long can you string people along with this narrative before they say, hey, we've given you millions of dollars. Where are those contracts? And he did this all because he knew all of this because he had had this experience in the DEA. But eventually, as all kinds of cons tend to do, this collapsed because people started to realize something was amiss. In the fall of 2012, there was a business plan that was being created for a cybersecurity startup that would focus on national security issues. And one guy named KB, who was a victim of this scheme, had asked Courtney to review documents for this new venture. And then Courtney comes back and says, look, I want to connect you with this guy named Curtin Windsor Jr. He's a former U.S. ambassador to Costa Rica. And get this, I thought you would love this. Courtney says, I know him pretty well. I know him from the Freemasons. We've been active together for years.
Nice.
Right. Whenever he needed to add a little mystery, he just sort of mad libs some Dan Brown stuff.
Yeah, it's like a step up version of like, oh, yeah, I know him from the Racquet Club, you know, or like from the Y, you know, we play tennis together. Oh, no, let's just take it. Let's just go ahead and go full in. I know him from the Illuminati.
Right. And so this guy who starts to unravel this Byzantine con game, he hasn't met this ambassador in person. But he understands that the ambassador may be able to provide some funding that they need, right? And Courtney texts KB with a link to an obituary for the ambassador's son and said, you know, he's been dealing with some stuff. That's why he hasn't gotten back to you, but he wants to go ahead and invest in your company. And then later, KB gets an email from a Gmail account in the ambassador's name, and they hammer out an agreement over email. But KB has a bad feeling because the ambassador says, look, I'm going to give you a $10 million loan at a 1% interest rate. And he goes, that doesn't make sense if this ambassador is trying to use this investment maybe as a tax shelter. And so Windsor says, look, I still believe Courtney, and Freemasonry rules say we can't give money directly to other members. So I'm doing the next, we're doing the next best thing because we're all friends here, right? That's how it works. We're all friends. He never really gets the funding, but he's waiting for it. He resigns, this guy, KB, he resigns from his job. He's still waiting for the money. He's getting more and more anxious. And then Courtney sends another text saying that this time the ambassador's wife has died. And then there was another email from the ambassador's Gmail account. KB is starting to wonder what's going on. Eventually, KB finds the ambassador's contact info, reaches out outside of that Gmail account. Someone answers the phone, and KB says, is this Anne Windsor? Yes, she says. And he says, ma'am, I heard you were dead. The ambassador wasn't at home. He was actually at a Masons meeting. But then he called KB and said, you know, who the hell
are
you?
Hold on. He was really at a Masons meeting?
He was really at a Masons meeting. That part was true. So he was like, who the hell are you? I've never heard of your company. I have never heard of that Gmail account. And I would certainly not promise to loan you, a freaking stranger, $10 million. Jeez. But I do know this Garrison Courtney guy you mentioned. He actually got kicked out of the Masons last year.
Wow. Wait, how do you get kicked out of the Masons? Like, you mess up a ritual, or you just...
No, probably unscrupulous behavior or something to that effect, or wasn't paying, behavior. You know. I mean,
you pay dues?
I don't know.
That's how do you get kicked out of the Masons? Former Masons, let us know. I think most people just stopped going to the meetings. I was not aware. It makes sense you could get kicked out of the Masons. Maybe you do a crime of moral turpitude or something like that. So without getting too much further in the weeds, that's how it starts to unravel. But the FBI almost weren't able to get him because he was very close to signing documents that would have given him full legal immunity.
Wow. He was going to Epstein it?
He was, yes.
Jeez.
Man. Yeah, because... he had convinced in the pre-sentencing investigation, he was saying, look, I had so many people convinced. I had so many people believing in this program I had made up that it looked like it was on the verge of maybe becoming real just because of the people who were investing in it and becoming involved. Like, if enough powerful people in the government say we're doing this, then... In my mind, it means it's happening.
Yeah, eventually he can land a meeting with the CIA and say, hey, look, I've got this operation that I'm pitching to you as an operation, but it's already an operation, but it could be yours for yes. a low, low price.
Exactly. So get this, and I'll soap the story here. So get this. He he managed to convince a number of these public officials, some of whom are not named yet, but very powerful. He managed to convince them to intervene and stop the FBI investigation in the name of national security. And one guy went so far as to threaten the FBI agents themselves, like, I will end your career if you keep endangering this. And he became very close to effectively immunizing himself from prosecution, because if his program, even if it's bogus, gets that that official credibility under national security law, then he's above all the other laws. So it's amazing that they caught him when they did. And it makes me think, first off, it's a great conspiracy, but it also makes me think, has this happened before? Have other people got, like, could we do this?
Dude, well, I mean, it reminds me of Bernie Madoff a little bit, just some of the tactics of being already inside with a bunch of people who are in the group, right, that you're going to be influencing. And when you start from that position, as he was, you said DEA, right? Spokesperson for the Drug Enforcement Agency.
Yeah, Chief of Public Affairs, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, he's already got all those connections. People know who he is. I mean, once you start there, it feels like the sky's the limit for cons that you could at least attempt to implement. This one just happened to be ridiculously successful.
But surely that kind of designation could be revoked, right? Like, it's not like, here's your golden ticket and you're untouchable for life.
Well, it's not even that, right? Oh, are you talking about the...
The immunity.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. If anything, it would just change it into a lengthy legal battle about something else besides what he had actually done wrong.
That's true. It would go through the hedge maze of appeals, right? Because mm-hmm. You would try to appeal that decision. But anyhow, that is my strange news for today. I believe that he has been sentenced or is scheduled to be sentenced as October of 2020. So really, he's kind of a spy, a fake spy who turned into a real spy, and he was just working for himself. And he almost convinced the government to support his plan. And if the government did it, then that would have made it real. His con would have become real.
He wouldn't have gotten away with it too if it hadn't have been for those pesky kids.
Pesky KB.
And that puppy.
And there you go. Garrison Courtney. With some life goals for you.
Yeah. So I guess you got to be the change. I guess he was like really into the secret. And we're going to be back with more strange news after a word from our sponsor.
All right, and we're back. And Ben, I would say that Garrison Courtney certainly belongs on the list of like assholes of the week, you know, defrauding people, running roughshod over the law. But at least he had a little bit of panache, you know, he had some flair and some style in his hustle. My particular a-hole is just kind of a disgusting, you know, what's the word I'm looking for?
Reprobate.
Yeah.
Degenerate. Noel, your a-hole is a reprobate degenerate?
Sure is. That's my a-hole. But his name is Fontrell Antonio Baines, a.k.a. Nuke Bizzle, which I think could go down in history as one of the lamest rap names I've ever heard personally. What do you think, Ben?
It's up there. I'm going to be honest. I wanted to check out his work first. I haven't yet. There was an obscure album, I think, from the 90s that had an MC featured on it named Shorty Stain. That's still the true story. That's still a high point for me. But yeah, Nuke Bizzle, I don't know. Do we know the etymology?
Well, I'm assuming nuke is in like, you know, nukes, nuclear. Bizzle, I guess, is short for business. So nuclear business.
That's okay. Interesting.
I assume he's boasting about his rap prowess implying that it'll go nuclear, you know?
There we go.
His bars. But he seems to be a lot less focused on the rap game and more on the con game. And also just flagrantly, like, you know, what is it? Playing himself, I guess, as the kids might say, right? So what Nuke Bizzle did... Fontrell Antonio Baines, 31 years old. He was arrested this past Friday and charged with three different felonies: access device fraud, aggravated identity theft, and interstate transportation of stolen property. And that's according to federal prosecutors. He is currently facing a prison sentence of up to 22 years. And that's because he basically, there's a thing called the CARES program that is intended to provide relief for people who have lost their job due to the coronavirus pandemic. The Coronavirus Aid, Relief, and Economic Securities Act, the CARES Act, that essentially, you know, was the thing that provided money, extended unemployment benefits to folks that experienced hardships due to the coronavirus pandemic. And yeah, it was essentially an expansion of unemployment benefits. We all remember that. It was like an extra, I think it was like $600 a month. It was a decent amount extra. And what Baines did was essentially game the system by stealing people's identities and getting $1.3 million of this aid money put on these prepaid debit cards. That is how this money is often dispersed. And used it to essentially finance like a lavish lifestyle in the Hollywood Hills. And then he went and made a video about it. The music video to the song EDD, which is a reference to California's Employment Development Department. And he basically brags about ripping off EDD as lines like "my swagger for EDD." He holds up stacks of these envelopes that are from the department, saying that he's getting rich by, quote, going to the bank with stacks of these. He's showing them off in the video. And essentially, this is what outed him. I mean, yeah. It was such a, you know, absolutely flagrant, you know, brazen con. I'm sure he would have gotten outed otherwise or gotten caught. But wow. Like,
yeah,
what a boneheaded move to absolutely just like make a video rapping about, you know, how you're committing fraud. Not only, you know, sure, no one should defraud the government. We frown on tax lying on your taxes here. Yeah, it's stuff they don't want you to know.
Sometimes,
but this is literally taking money out of the pockets of people who need the money and stealing their identities. This could mess up people's credit like for years, make it very difficult for them to regain that status, all because this jerk decided that this con would be good to finance his, like, you know, gold grills and neck pieces and stuff.
Did he have a long-term plan?
It isn't clear. Okay. It is not clear. But he absolutely collected over $1 million. They also found about $50,000 in cash under the third row of seats in an Escalade, the vehicle that he was picked up in Las Vegas. And yeah.
The best part, though, what
he
about
consented his, to the search, by the way. You was the best part, Matt. Yeah.
Well, the best part were the number of you were talking about those prepaid debit cards,
right?
That are loaded up with the money. And that's how the funds are actually dispersed to an individual.
Let's think about how many of those it would take to make up $1.2 million. How many was it, Matt?
It was only it's a weird thing because I would think you would need more, but still. I've never been in possession. I've never known, or I can't even really think about what this would look like, but 92 debit cards. I guess if you stacked them up, that would be a nice hefty stack.
Oh, in total, right? Because he had eight on him.
Yeah.
When he was arrested, but 92 have been traced to him, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And that's where you get the $1.2 million number that has been bandied about.
This reminds me of something. First off, we see this more often in social media where someone will brag about something and be surprised to find out, you know, the local police department also has a Facebook page.
Right.
And that's, yeah. That's a tale as old as social media. But what's interesting about this one, Noel, is he may have gotten away if he had just not made the video. It reminds me a little bit of a unique subculture in Nigeria that's been on my mind. Nigeria has been on my mind in general a lot recently. Have you guys ever heard of the Yahoo Boys?
No.
They like do the, it's very interesting. They do the same, similar things. It's like you've heard, we've all heard in the West, the idea of like the Nigerian prince scam. I have $40 million. I just need someone to hold it for me, right? Because international banking, please email me back. The Yahoo Boys are scammers who make a living doing that and are very open about it. They're kind of celebrities in some corners of Nigeria. And then, you know, internationally, and some get into music as well. I'm just wondering, like, Nuke Bizzle was inspired by, I don't know. I wonder if he was aware of it. I wonder how many other people are scamming folks, right? Do you think there's a lot?
Oh, well, yeah. Actually, as it turns out, in September, the state of Arizona, after an audit, said that it had red flagged more than 1 million of 2.4 million unemployment claims as potentially fraudulent.
Really?
That's more than 40% during a 6-week period over the summer. And then Colorado, over a 6-week period over the summer, found that 77% of new claims under this pandemic unemployment assistance program were fraudulent.
Wow.
So no, Nuke Bizzle is not alone. And there's a funny little detail too, by the way. He was rapping in the video with another associate of his named Fat Wizza, but I keep reading it and in my mind I just see Fat Pizza, which I kind of like better in a lot of ways. But yeah, in the video, apparently that this wasn't in originally, but they added a disclaimer at some point that said that the video was made with props for entertainment purposes.
Right.
Only. Mm-hmm.
Nice. But I don't think you can plead public entertainment in court.
Nope.
You can't be like, Honor, listen, when I stole that Corvette, I think we can all agree it was hilarious. I was dressed like Elvis, so you got to give me that.
Identity theft is no joke. I mean, ask expressvpn.com. It's a thing that happens every day, and I've thankfully never been a victim of it, but it seems like a nightmare. It's not like the internet equivalent of getting rear-ended by somebody, and then sure, it wasn't your fault, but your car's still jacked up, and you have to deal with it, you know, and you have to, like, hopefully get paid back or made whole by this other person's maybe shitty insurance.
Mm. Yeah, that's definitely, I'm sure there are people out there, I'm sure maybe you even have experienced identity theft of some kind. It is not a walk in the park. Though, it's interesting, let me just say something else that was from this LA Times article. There's another MC in that EDD video, which at least the original one is offline right now, by the way. But the other MC had a line where he said, it was a boast, right? It's something that we see a lot where there's a couple of lines that are boasting about, you know, how much, how awesome I am, basically.
Braggadocio?
Sure.
In hip hop?
Yeah. Well, that's what I mean. It's a very common thing.
Well, that's the formula. It's A, I'm great. B, you suck. C, here's why.
Yeah. And so one of the lines here was, you got to sell cocaine. I just file a claim, So I guess my question to you is, overall, in the scheme of things, when you're talking, you know, when you're talking about greater good, largest negative impact, which one is worse? Someone who is trying to get by as an MC and selling cocaine mm-hmm. to, you know, to supplement their income, or someone who is committing fraud against the government?
I think it's tricky because first respond, one, how much cocaine? Two, and how are they selling it?
Let's say equivalent dollars.
Okay. And then so a little over 760,000. So then the next question would be, like, what kind of fraud? This kind of fraud, identity theft fraud, which is, I would say, starkly unethical. Without sounding pretentious, I'm gonna say that I would posit that the greatest and most profound violation of ethics comes from the people with the power to change systems that put folks in a situation where they have to sell drugs to survive, or put folks in a situation where filing a fraudulent claim seems like a necessary thing to do. People will do what they have to survive. I know there are other ways, but I think we can't absolve the creators of the system of their responsibility.
I couldn't agree with you more, Ben, in certain situations, but let's not forget this guy was living large in the Hollywood Hills, you know, off of fraudulent money that he stole from people who really needed it. I mean, I would say he was doing a little more than surviving, you know?
Yeah, that's a fair point. That's a fair point. Maybe that tips the scales, because we have to remember that already in some segments of the U.S. population was tremendously controversial for people to get any kind of help at all, right, from the federal government, because there's still that very racist myth of the welfare queen that does not hold up to statistics. It doesn't hold up to research demographically or any metric. So then we have to consider that the effects of this crime are not just the 91 other people who had their identity stolen for the CARES Act, but it's also going to inevitably have an effect on people in need of assistance in future similar situations.
That's right.
Yeah. Now someone can say if they're one of the Americans against the idea of helping fellow citizens, which I can't believe is a huge thing in politics, but it still very much is, then this is the kind of like exhibit A that those folks will point to. Why should we bother helping people not starve? Why should we bother helping people not sleep with their children in dirty alleys? Because look, this one guy did this.
No, yeah. It's a really good point, Ben. And of course, because of the absurdity of it, too, it's going to get a lot of press, probably more press than all of those other fraudulent claims that are listed in this LA Times article. I just want to cap this one off with an interesting discovery that I just made. The video in question here has been taken down, but not by the artist himself. I'm not even going to call him an artist. That's a bit of a stretch. Not by this gentleman himself. I think that's being a little too kind as well. But because of a copyright claim made by someone by the name of Rayshawn Williams, who is a member of a songwriting collective known as Section 8, and they have a song called We Paid by Lil Baby and 42 Doug that is, according to Wikipedia, a braggadocious song about the rapper's wealth and come-ups. Regarded as a standout cut from My Turn, the song received rave reviews from critics. This seems like they wrote it themselves, the Wikipedia entry, by the way. But yeah, so the song was a ripoff too. So there you go.
He has a song called Tekashi, by the way, which I'm going to check out after we record this
episode. Isn't that another rapper?
Yeah, Tekashi 6ix9ine. Right now, probably the most famous non-political snitch in the U.S. zeitgeist.
Didn't he die? Didn't he like OD or something or get bumped off?
No.
I don't think so.
He claimed that he was hard and that he was in the gangster lifestyle, but it turned out he was both a child abuser.
That's right.
And he also was an absolute, like a snitch to the level of God-tier memery. He squealed on all of his former associates very quickly when he ran into legal issues. I would just say Google Tekashi snitch.
Yeah, it was Triple X Tentacion, who was an associate of Tekashi 6ix9ine that was killed.
Mm-hmm.
That guy he was with the 9 Trey Bloods.
Yeah.
Interesting.
He was kind. I don't know. He was kind of with them. He was with them the way Frank Sinatra was with the mob.
Do you say all three X's and XXX Tentacion? How do you say that?
I think you just say the X to like the degree the spirit moves you.
Okay.
You know what I mean? Maybe depending on the beat.
Tentacion.
That guy's horrible too, though.
Right. Yeah. And he was killed, I believe.
So, Noel, we know this guy has been arrested. He's facing charges, obviously, but he hasn't been sentenced, right? Like, this hasn't gone to trial?
No, he's due to appear in downtown L.A. federal court this Friday. That's tomorrow, the 22nd, as we're recording this. So, be interesting to follow up. I don't know, how do you think that dude's going to get treated in prison? It's not a very cool con.
I don't know, man. It's weird because he didn't physically harm anybody. He caused harm to people, right? If like in the legal sense, right. But he didn't harm anybody. So,
mm-hmm. Well, I don't know. But you could argue that lacking that fun. Here's the question for you guys. Yes, he defrauded the government. Mm-hmm. Did he defraud these people, or were they people that weren't going to get it anyway and didn't really even notice? Like, was he basically taking money out of their pockets, or was he just using these identities as a means to get the money for himself? Like, did people lose out on benefits because of this? I would think yes, but it's not mm-hmm. quite clear from the details that we know. What do you guys think?
Well, demographically, it depends on their socioeconomic situation before this began. That's a good question. You know what I mean? Because imagine it's quite possible that one of those 90 plus people tried to file a claim and were told they already had filed a claim. And now the burden is on them to get this sorted out, their time. Their money, their expense. But prison has a definite hierarchy, and identity fraud doesn't necessarily make you as much of a target in lockup as some other crimes would. So I don't know.
Certainly.
Also, a lot of it goes to your affiliations on the outside and how they translate to the inside. If he has money to put in people's commissary, then I'm sure he can get some kind of protection. But I also think the government is very closely watching his money and where it does or does not go.
I would imagine so. Last little detail, I don't think we mentioned, he did withdraw over $700,000 of these benefits in cash at various ATMs. Knowing that an ATM has some like kind of cash limit, right? For what is it, $500 for a day? I guess it depends. They would have had to hit up a lot of ATMs to make this happen.
Yeah.
And not trigger any alarms.
Well, there you go. Nuke Bizzle.
Nuke Bizzle. Rest in Pizzle.
And
or Prizzle.
Now we're going to pause for a word from our sponsor. When we return, we're going to explore a troubling example of something that we kind of predicted many years ago.
Hello, and we're back. Now, this next story, it is pretty recent. We have three time frames in which we're going to be operating here. So the first of which is very recently, within the past week. The second of which is within roughly a month before today that you are listening to this. And then the third one is way back in 1944. So let's start in 1944, set some stuff up, and then we'll move ahead. So there was a treaty back in 1944, an agreement essentially, that was signed between the United States and Mexico, and it was very specific. It was a treaty that stated that the United States and Mexico would share water, because there are two very important rivers that flow right there along the border, the Rio Grande, which is the largest one, at the border between the United States and Mexico, and the Colorado River, which is very, very close, not very, very close within feet. But if you look at a large map, the Colorado River is right there near the border as well. And the concept here is that when it is necessary during certain times of the year, when one of these rivers is not flowing a ton of water to the other country, when it's needed, like in the farmlands, let's say, in Mexico, the United States would be giving Mexico water. When there's farmland in the United States along that region that needs water, Mexico will be sending water to them. It's essentially just, hey, when you need, we'll give. When we need, please give. That's the treaty.
What could go wrong?
I mean, it's a great idea, right? That's a cool thing. We've both got these water sources. Let's use them together. The problem, I think, comes in the fact that there was a volume amount of water associated with this treaty, an amount that needed to be given. That way, the problem, I guess, that arises because there can be a deficit of water. Maybe Mexico isn't giving enough. Maybe the United States isn't giving enough. Let's hit these numbers really quickly. Mexico is supposed to send 350,000 acre feet of water from the Rio Grande to the United States, and that's on a yearly basis. And that essentially replenishes reservoirs that are located within the United States. And again, a lot of it is used for irrigation, for farming. Then the United States every year sends 1.5 million acre feet of water to Mexico via the Colorado River. And that water comes from a lot of the southwestern states right there. So we've got that set up as the treaty. That's our grounding. Then let's travel to roughly a month prior to today. There have been increasing tensions in a couple of places along the border there of Mexico and the United States. Some of the tensions are occurring in places in Texas and a couple other states in the United States. And there's other tensions that are happening in the state of Chihuahua in Mexico and a couple other places right there along the border. The tensions are in Mexico right now owes the United States quite a bit of water, according to this treaty. And again, it's kind of a cumulative thing where they owe a lot of water, at least according to this treaty, to the United States. And there are also pretty extreme drought conditions in Mexico right now. The conditions are the worst they've been in roughly three decades. So that means there is farmland in Mexico and farmers, human beings, families that need water desperately, but they don't have it. And meanwhile, Mexico is being forced through this treaty to send just so much water. I mean, again, if they're going to hit their numbers this year, it'll be 350,000 acre feet of water, which is a ton. So obviously, there are individuals who are upset at the state of affairs here, and enough individuals got together and were feeling the same way that they decided to protest against this action that was being taken. And they organized and they actually took some pretty serious action a month ago when they ambushed soldiers, National Guard, Mexican National Guard soldiers at a dam. And they actually ended up taking over the dam and slowed down the water flow into the United States. Now, when you get a picture of that in your mind, you imagine some kind of operation in a movie or something. No, no, no. We're talking individual farmers with weapons that they have, like makeshift weapons that they have found, or tools or things like that, and rocks. And they were able to essentially outsmart the National Guard there, because they know the territory, they know the area, they knew the dam, and they were able to take control of it fully from National Guard. There was a general who was actually there, who was deployed with the National Guard to protect the dam as tensions were rising, who actually realized that he and the National Guard were defeated, so he actually surrendered to the citizens.
What do you call this? Like the battle of? Like, I mean, this seems like it could be a cool movie, if not like an episode of something.
Well, I mean, it could be a cool movie.
The question is, what happens next?
The problem is, what this is showing us is part of a much bigger problem that we've talked about on the show many times. The forthcoming, the very soon to be here water wars that Ooh. All of us, not one human withstanding, will be involved in at some point in our lives.
Yeah.
And this is just one version of how it can go down when there's desperation, when there seems to be some kind of law or government, or maybe a combination of a law and an acting government, a force that says, hey, we've got this stuff on the books and we have to do this thing. It means moving resources, even though you know, citizens of this country to whom we serve, need this thing. We have to give it over. We have to send it in some other way or to some other place because it's necessary.
You can imagine that's tremendously unpopular if you're, say, the president of Mexico, right?
Yeah.
If it's okay, Matt, before we get to the macrocosmic stuff.
Yeah, please.
In Mexico, there's an additional problem. These farmers will not have the government on their side in general because they're not supporters of the current president, López Obrador, right?
Yeah, it's an interesting thing. So, oh gosh, and I do not want to insult anybody who is listening here, and I do not want to make generalizations, but there's a fascinating thing where the farmers are fairly well off comparatively to my understanding, to the reporting that's been done by Al Jazeera and numerous other outlets. Mm-hmm. The farmers are actually a little more prosperous than many of their neighbors who are not farmers in some of these areas in Chihuahua. And I don't think it's a one-to-one ratio, but you might say they are more along the lines of conservative when it comes to government practices for economics. Would you say that's incorrect, Ben?
No. Historically, you're spot on because these farmers are located in the northern part of the country. So mm-hmm. historically, traditionally, that's kind of a heartland or HQ of conservative opposition to the current government, which is run on the current administration is on a more leftist platform. This has already generated a lot of resentment in the farming community. There was one quote in a New York Times article that you sent us in preparation for this that really stood out to me, where we have a farmer, a kid. He's named Francisco Marta. He's 23 years old. And he says of the president, he believes we're rich and nothing will happen to us if we don't work next year. But that's not true. I myself will migrate if I don't have anywhere to work here. So, I mean, one person's rich is a matter is relative ultimately, oh, right?
100%. And again, when we're talking about the stakes here, we're talking about next year's harvest. There needs to be enough water to irrigate the farms for next year's harvest, because we're talking about filling reservoirs ultimately with a lot of this water flow that's occurring. It's not as though the water is going directly from the river into an aqueduct or something that is then fueling the farming. It's going to reservoirs that then will be used later. Mm-hmm. The whole situation, I think, it's very complicated. It's not an easy thing to fix. And you also have the added pressure of the United States government and, you know, the current administration that there does seem to be a tendency to want to begin some kind of trade conflict or trade war to better the stance that the United States has within whatever, you know, whatever deals are in place.
Yeah.
So you can imagine there's a lot of pressure on the Mexican president to cater to some extent to the United States just to maintain the prosperity of those trade deals that are already existing. And it just means for each individual person, you're kind of being held hostage to the governmental machine, I guess, right, in a lot of ways. And it feels like that's what we're going to be set up with across the globe very, very soon. Where there's not much we can do. We're just kind of being held hostage, and hopefully there's enough water to go around and Nestle won't own all of it.
Ah, but okay. So here we go. Here we go. What's that old adage? When elephants make war, it's the grass that suffers. The people are the individual blades of grass. And you'll find a lot of folks arguing that the treaty, which, as you said, was negotiated in the World War II era, is actually really good for Mexico, and it's tough to improve upon it in a way that benefits the country more. But the country is not – what benefits the country does not necessarily benefit the individuals who have their livelihoods affected by this. I got to say, I mean, let's get dystopian. Imagine – and now, macrocosmically, what's weird about this is happening in multiple places around the globe, right? And the idea of this tension here We have to say that all things aside, it would be advantageous to the U.S., especially now, to renegotiate this treaty on terms they found more favorable. But things like this are happening at borders across the world, right? Middle East, like Jordan's having issues. The scary dystopian thing for me, like writing this as a horror story, imagine a world where individuals are tracked on water debt. What if that's the new student loan debt? Like you have to pay off your water debt, because that's what's happening with Mexico right now. That's not a phrase we made up. It's called water debt.
Yeah. Wow. Water payments, water debt and water payments.
Your personal water debt. Yeah.
Well, you know, in a human is what, 70 something percent water? Mm-hmm. You could just give yourself, I guess. It's a stupid, sacrifice.
Maybe a stupid question, but is it legal? Are there guidelines around, say, collecting your own river water and like filtering it yourself and not using municipalities at all?
If you're not Nestle, yes.
Yeah. There are guidelines in some states within the U.S. Mm-hmm. where you can't even gather rainwater.
Yep.
Like, it is illegal to gather rainwater.
Even with those like rain barrels, like for like irrigating plants, like they sell those at Lowe's.
I don't know the individual statutes for all of them, but I know there are several places. We covered that back in the day when we were doing, I think, the General Water Wars episodes. Mm-hmm. And you just have to be careful.
Colorado. Yeah. In Colorado, it is the only thing you can do is collect up to 110 gallons. Of water and rain barrels. Other than that, it's completely illegal to harvest rain barrels, anything or rain water past that. That's going to be, we're going to see that continuing, because a lot of places in the world right now, we have to remember, they get water from glaciers, which are not going to be sustainable. Or they get like Libya had built one of the most fascinating, ambitious irrigation projects in human history, because they had a reservoir of what's called fossil water, underground, drinkable fresh water that is just like a one-time bonus. It's not renewing. Yeah. So that's maybe scary. It's the first. I mean, I don't know, Matt. What do you think is going to happen to these farmers? Because you can see both. I guess it's easy to see both sides of the argument here, but are they going to be successful? Is the president going to negotiate with these folks to help keep their farms viable for the coming years?
It's interesting, because I don't even know how much good I just don't fully grasp it. But to my understanding, the actions being taken at this one, I think it's the Boquilla Dam, it doesn't seem like it's actually going to make that big of an impact on the farmers there in Chihuahua. It's tough. What I would say is it's tremendously encouraging to see people's on an individual level like that attempting to make it right, or what they see as to fix a big problem. Mm-hmm. But it's also scary that type of desperation is already being felt enough in 2020 that, you know, people would physically gather together and attempt to fight a National Guard force in order to get water. If the desperation is already there, and I know it's even higher in other places, maybe just action isn't being taken yet. I don't know. I mean, I feel so conflicted about the whole thing. It's gotta feel weird to live in a place where you know you need water and you don't have enough water, and you're watching a giant river like the Rio Grande send water away, and you know that your government is doing that, and you have access to it, you just need a way to get that water to where you need it.
Yeah, and that's something that about a quarter of the world's population face, that dilemma, extreme water shortages, the things that are fueling conflict or adding gas to the fire here. Yemen, India, Central America, the border, Mexico, and areas like you're saying, to parts of Africa. It's insane that shortage is that large and extensive already, you know? It's a tough problem because going back to your earlier question, Noel, one of the big difficulties we found in that is in the idea of who owns the common good, right? It's the tragedy of the commons, right? Everybody needs a resource that's freely available or was for the vast span of time. And now we enter the idea of ownership, or we introduce the idea of ownership. The reason that Matt and I are just taking shots at Nestle left and right is because they're buying up aquifers and they're extracting the water. And so it's leaving that ecosystem or that region. And, you know, it's being sold for $1.29 or $1.59 or $2.19 or whatever in a bottle. And when they're buying this land, they're getting it for pennies. And their profit margin on the water they're extracting is insane. And it's not coming back to those communities. So many people live off the grid right now. And maybe listening to this show, as you're like harvesting rainwater, as you're, you know, checking the creek, those people are usually not going to get busted. They're much more likely to get busted for like hunting out a season or hunting without a license or trespassing than getting a drink of water. Where we're at right now in the U.S., generally, people aren't going to have a problem with you doing that until you start to do it in massive amounts again if you are not a company. If you're a company, I think you just have to pay the right people.
You just drink it up.
Drink the milkshake.
I drink your milkshake.
Right.
All right. Drink it up. Wow. I think we will stop talking about this one. If you guys are there, maybe if you were at the Boquilla Dam, if you know a family member, or if you know or are experiencing a water shortage and are feeling desperate, we'd love to hear your thoughts, what you're dealing with. Any kind of solutions that exist out there. We'd love to hear from you. You can find us on Twitter and on Facebook, where we're Conspiracy Stuff, and on Instagram, where we are Conspiracy Stuff Show.
And don't feel limited there. If you would also like to talk to us about internet scams in general, like if you have a plan to be a fake CIA spy that gets just so one course hair away from becoming the real deal, and tell us your story. Tell us also your take on the ethics of filing false claims. Do that, as Matt said, on social media. Right? You can also give us a direct call on our phone number, 1-833-STDWYTK. 3 minutes. Tell us what's on your mind as the spirit moves you. The only thing you have to do is let us know if it's okay to use your name and voice on air.
And don't forget to join our favorite little slice of the internet, the Here's Where It Gets Crazy Facebook group. We'd love to see you on there. We hang out plenty, and the folks that interact there every day are just the best, and there's a lot of really cool discussions about episodes and memes and posts and all kinds of things to keep you busy for hours.
And don't forget, youtube.com/conspiracystuff. All of our content since 2013, it's all there. And there's new stuff posted all the time. Check it out. Subscribe. Tell your friends. And, you know, also Apple Podcasts. If you go on there and you leave a review, it really does help, especially if it's positive. It doesn't have to be positive. It can be constructive. Just it actually helps us. If you want to give back, that's the way to do it.
Give back. It's true. It makes us feel good in our hearts. If you don't want to do any of that stuff, that's cool. There's another way you can get in touch with us. You can send us a good old-fashioned email. We are
conspiracy@iHeartRadio.com.
Stuff They Don't Want You to Know is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.